So today I'm going to talk to you about.
So
Victor asked me to give a presentation about the epsilon and the 1 over n expansion. But then I realized I would like to talk about that. I probably would need to explain actually why is this problem interesting in the first place. And although we had a few talks about BCS crossover, by Sajdev, Nandini, Danchi, most of the people that are here today actually were not there at the time. So I decided to, even though I'm giving a blackboard talk, to actually give a little review of the BCS-BC crossover before I go on to explain the large N and the epsilon expansion. So you might be already familiar with some of these details. Okay, so we're interested in the problem with fermions. In practice, for alkali atoms, we have two possible choices, either lithium-6 or potassium-40. And do we have a working pointer or something? Okay, I'll just use a stick here, actually. It does work.
We're going to use a stick.
Okay. And so these, let's say if we take lithium-6, actually, we can trap these atoms in two actually hyperfine states, MF of plus or minus half, and that we have here. And then these actually, if here I plot here the energy spectrum for non-attracting atoms, and we can change the energy splitting between them by applying an external magnetic field. It does happen that there's actually using this flashback resonance, so that is if we have a bond state nearby, by tuning the energy difference between the open and the so-called closed channel from the flashback resonance, we can tune this bond state to be in line actually with the energy of this open channel. And when that does happen, we have a resonance, so between this bond state and the scattering length diverges at a particular point. And beyond that, then the state, if we go to the lower magnetic field which pushes down this bound state, then we have the formation of a bound state which its energy then goes like h bar square over 2m as square, where as is the scattering length. And so what you need to know, though, from the point of view of calculation, is actually that you can actually kind of forget all about this, and you take away just two ingredients. One is the mass of the atoms, and you have two such species, up and down, and the interaction strength, which would tend to be a contact interaction, so that's an attractive contact interactions. So lambda should be negative. And so this applies in the case of so-called broad resonance. And broad means that as opposed to narrow, in the case of narrow resonance, you can have a long-lived excitation that are metastable. In the case of broad resonance, this does not happen. And so lambda, so the potential doesn't have any structure, and can be simply characterized by this Hamiltonian. And here on this plot, I show what happened in the case of potassium-40 when they measure the scattering length, and in units of the Bohr radius. And you can see actually that they achieve a scattering length which actually are in the range of like up to 3,000s actually of the Bohr radius. So that can be quite large, actually, at this so-called unitarity point. So this again, this scattering length is tuned by a magnetic field, but we, in our case, we'll think about that we change this coupling lambda. And there's a bit of an issue about this Hamiltonian, which is that it's actually, there's an ultraviolet divergence, actually. So really, this is somewhat of an ill-defined model, but we can cure it by actually redefining one over lambda in terms of this scattering length through this parameterization. So in this way, we can eliminate completely this coupling one over lambda in terms of the scattering length. And so there's a very few parameters, as you can see in this problem. So there's mu, but mu is defined by the density. And so on very general ground, we can say that the free energy should be proportional to EF, the Fermi energy, times only two parameters, KBT over EF and KF times the scattering length. So these are only two dimensionless parameters we can make, and that depends on some function, G here, which is unknown.
If you have a cutoff, which value of lambda can give you the unitary point?
So let's say actually this, we don't have a contact attraction, but we have a smooth kernel of some length, let's say rho naught. Then here actually you could calculate what is the scattering length, and that would be given by 1 over lambda plus 1 over v, and you sum over q here, which will go over only q wave vector that goes to 1 over rho naught. And so then 1 over lambda there. So this model actually would be physical in that sense. And that
case.
That's right, yeah.
By the way, so I know it's a dangerous question, but in this picture here, those points are experimental data, so they actually measure the scattering length.
Okay. There's several ways to actually measure the scattering length. In that particular case, actually, what they looked at is you take a gas, and then there's a point actually right here where the scattering length vanishes. So what they do is actually they know due to the scattering length, this creates a pressure. And so the gas has some size actually that is larger due to mean field interaction, 4 pi as m times the density. So that creates. So then, if you can think of this in mean field level, so this you can write this as a density, and for low a or small as, or if you have KF that is much smaller than AS, then the effect is actually changing the energy of the system toward density factor. And so they can relate that to actually the size of the cloud. And by measuring the size of the cloud, they can then invert what scattering length is. But that works only in the regime where KF times the scattering length is actually small. And so when they measure that here, actually, they have to have very few particles in the trap in order to be able to measure it.
Is the universal property energy, is that a
statement? So if you say that, if you take, let's say you have a kernel that relates actually, so it's not a contact interaction, then the model actually would be cut off at some value k, which goes like 1 over R naught, which would be the kernel that guides these interactions. And so the statement here is that this kernel doesn't show up ever, so that the 1 over lambda and R naught always appear actually in such a way that they replaced by one of the scattering lambda. And that's true if R naught goes to zero.
It's a scaling argument?
Yeah, it's a scaling argument, yeah.
Genetically should be valid.
That's right, yeah. Okay. So for the so here I'm plotting things as a function of the magnetic field, and so if I at a large magnetic field, then the scattering length is actually negative, and then but we don't form a bound state, so we have the resonance is actually above actually your energy, and one doesn't form any bound state in the vacuum, but you can actually induce interactions by going to this bound state and coming back, and then that creates an attraction. And in this case, actually, one is in the so-called BCS regime, where you have weak attractions from Cooper pairs, and then this is a regime here where KF times scattering length is much smaller than 1. If we go, if you increase interaction strength, then you can form a real bound state in the vacuum, and one can form strongly bound pairs. So in this case, we are in this molecular regime, where again, KF times AS is much smaller than 1. So KF again, if I did not emphasize that, is given by 1 over the separation between, roughly 1 over the separation between the particle. So again, in that case, you're in the dilute Bose gas. And in the intermediate regime there, so there's the scattering length actually diverges, then you're in this so-called strong coupling regime, and where your bond state is actually on resonance. And here, we don't have actually a small parameter to expand around, contrary to actually in this BCS or molecular regime there. And so this is, unless you do an expansion at high temperature, this is a problem which doesn't have any small parameter. And this is, so we don't know exactly how to tackle that. But for a long time, actually, people didn't worry too much about this. And so, and actually,
starting in the late 60s and the beginning of the 80s,
Leggett and Eagles look at this problem using a mean field BCS BCE crossover. So they use this variational approach where they argue that the ground state remain pair condensate throughout, actually, this crossover. And so they wrote BCS wave functions where the U's and the V's actually are minimized. And in that case, one can write, I guess, a gap equation, and also in the case of where you want to fix the number of particles, a particle equations, and they solve for both delta and U actually in the problem. And what they did find is actually so that in the BCS limit, then delta over EF increases exponentially, and at some point increase in, I think it goes like 3 over 2 power actually of 1 over KFA in the BC limit. And you can see you have a smooth crossover in between, so it just interpolates smoothly. And the same for the chemical potential in the BCS limits, of course, mu is roughly is equal to EF D when the interaction strength is small, and the BC limit at large value, then what happens is then the mu becomes equal to this so-called the binding energy of the molecules, which is equal to 1 minus 1 over 2 m. The scattering length square. So all things evolve smoothly, and in particular, you know, there's no quantum phase transition going from from the so-called BCS to BEC regime. So you have a like smooth evolution of like the physical quantities. And here I plot, you know, for instance, the excitation gaps also evolves smoothly across the resonance, and it goes. I think someone had a question about this at earlier workshop, where this is in the BEC regime, then delta, the order parameter is equal to delta, the single particle excitations, but in rather in the BEC regime rather, then they are actually different, and they are it's given by delta over EF excitation is given by actually mu, the chemical potential, which is actually the cost of actually separating a molecule. So you see, so most actually, if you plot most functions throughout the crossover, they're actually monotonic functions, and one has to look pretty hard actually to find functions which are not monotonic. And this is one of them actually, that's the so-called adiabatic index, which is the derivative of the pressure with respect to the density times the density over the pressure. And the pressure is essentially at zero temperature is minus the energy of the system. And for Fermi gas, it goes like the density to the 5/3. So this is why you get this value here. Whereas in the BEC regime, well, the pressure is proportional to the density square. So if gamma in this case is equal to 2, the exponent. And here it goes down here and then recover here. That's an interesting fact that gamma at 1 over KFA is actually should be exactly 5/3 actually on very general ground actually, which actually I'll.
Martin, yep. Even though this excitation gap is monotonic, I mean that function is not analytic.
That's right. Okay, that function is not. However, this if you look at any thermodynamic quantities, they're smoothly okay. But delta, the excitation gap, is not an analytic function. But then it doesn't affect any thermodynamic properties. So then you're on safe ground.
That's just the BCS. I mean, that's the mean field result there.
That's right. So
is it correct that there is a non-analyticity there?
It's mainly by minimizing all the point case.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The non-analyticity. So the function is smooth, but you get a minimized
right.
Plus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that then said some PCS and
So, okay, the situation is a bit different at finite temperature, where if one uses this mean field approach, so one can write against a variational approach based on minimizing some parameter delta, and if one solves for it, one finds actually that as one varies the scattering length, one goes from the BCS regime where the temperature is exponential and then increase actually in a monotonic fashion to a very high temperature. And here this is plotted as a function of Tc over EF, the Fermi energy. And actually if one includes the Gaussian fluctuation, one gets a very different pictures. And it's pretty clear that this has to be incorrect actually right here, because we know that deep in the BC regime, so one over KFA is very large, then the BC temperature should be independent of actually one over KFA, should go to a constant. So the resolution to that was actually brought by Nozier, which realized actually one has to include Gaussian fluctuation in the action. And in the process, so you should what you think about that this field delta actually has its phase actually can change, and so it's not a constant at all temperature. And if one calculates this propagator, one finds that the BEC regime is given by a simple one particle propagator, which was like 1/1 omega times the binding energy plus a kinetic term that goes like q squared to the 4m, 4 being because this describe actually it describes the kinetic energy of actually a molecule which has a binding energy of eb here. And so if one then actually calculates instead the particle equation, one finds that as an additional contribution that comes from essentially the entropy of these molecules that we have here. And that, if we solve for these equations, then Nozier realized that then we recover what should expect actually in the BEC regime.
So what's the definition of T-squared?
Oh, so what's the definition of T squared? This is actually
T star
is it's a real effect actually, which is associated with so if you on this side in the BC regime you have a Fermi gas, and if as you go down in temperature eventually they form a Cooper pair and you have a superfluid in this region at a temperature which is given by this, which is exponentially suppressed by -1/kFA. However, in this regime here, as you come down in temperature, these particles actually eventually bind from a real molecule, and so they have, you have bosons at this in this intermediate regime, which some people like to call pseudo gap. But these bosons are not condensed yet, actually. So only at much lower temperature, which is given roughly by the Fermi energy, do they condense. And so this temperature scale is the binding energy. So this is there's a with a correction of a log due to some entropic effect, because it's slightly suppressed than the binding energy, because from an entropic perspective, you gain more entropy by having two fermions actually around than just one molecule. But so essentially, this whole regime here, you should think of having a supposed gas of uncondensed bosons, and only here actually you reach this condensed phase. So right here, so if you go in the extreme actually BEC regime with 1/kFA, then you do recover that TC goes like I think 1/zeta to the result of non-attracting bosons. Exactly. Yeah. So this is, however, yeah. So with twice as large mass, that's right. That's right. So here actually I collected actually some of these asymptotic results that one can have in the low density limit and the both in the BCS limits with KF times the scattering length is much smaller. The absolute value of AS is much smaller than 1. So this is the energy per particle, and people, I think, starting in 20s started calculating what is the corrections to this having interactions. And so here, this is actually the result of that would derive, I think, even before, BCS. Theory, and it's simply because there should be actually a correction here which goes like e to the pi minus 2 kFa, but it's always smaller than kFas because that's within the exponential. And also the critical temperature, which is this was first calculated by BCS, and this factor of 1/4 e to the 1/3 actually is it turns out actually that's the correction to BCS formula, because BCS formula is only accurate to logarithmic precision. So this is a contribution that is called Melik, Bakudarov, and Gorkov corrections. And this actually is interesting because these parameters could never be actually tested within within a solid state context actually, because usually what comes in front of the critical temperature in the BCS regime is just h bar omega Dubai. However, in our case, we know all these actually parameters. We know the scattering length, and kF is directly related to density. So in principle, one could test actually that prediction. Gamma is the Euler-Mascheroni constant, 0.577. And in the same way, in the BC regime, actually, here I quote things in terms of the density of bosons, and the density of boson, of course, is just half the density of fermions, and the bosonic scattering length. And so one can also, people have derived a formula for the energy per particle in that limit, as well as always the critical temperature, which so in the BC limit, the critical temperature doesn't depend on the scattering length, it just depends on density, but there are corrections to it. And this result that was obtained rather recently, what is the scattering length of two bosons, two molecules with the scattering length of the fermions. So actually, even though we have a small parameter in this context, it's actually, I would say, still pretty hard actually to derive some of these results. Actually, it's
should we end B in the power of 1/3, I think, in the small parameter? Or A B in the power of 3?
Oh, right here, yeah. Yeah, you're right, actually. just like this, yeah. So here, actually, a bit to our shame, actually, I should point out actually that I was looking at. So this expansion here is someone claims to have calculated this to that precision. However,
this expression came out of a Gaussian fluctuation.
No, this comes out. So they treat. So this in this particular case, in some way you could think there should be a systematic way to do that, but actually, because you have one that has a small parameter, and you know, after they discover this BEC condensate, they thought, you know, this is the realization of physics that we knew from like, 70 years ago. But actually, the physics they knew from 70 years ago was only was this term, the critical temperature from in this non-attracting limit. And if you ask what is actually the first corrections due to the interactions to the critical temperature, that was not known until a few years ago. People did not know even if there was positive or negative. And here, actually, all the various estimate I pulled from Review of Modern Physics, none of them actually agree with one another, actually, so which is a bit of a shame.
The same forces of things differently. Eventually, what happens is that the group of Svitnov, Prokofiev, Kashur, Kopkir, and Arnold and Moore, they established by doing the lattice Monte Carlo that 1.3 is correct.
That's right, yeah. But somehow, it's a bit of a shame for condensed matter theorists because this guy is actually is a high energy physicist actually, and so he had to come in into the field and sort this out for us because all other people actually could not manage it right, even if we had the small parameter.
It's not very a shame because Prokofiev and Kashurnikov
are condensed matter physicists. Okay, okay.
So in fact, what happened is that they did their work slightly earlier than this Arnold and Moore. But when the paper was got published, the publication of Arnold and Moore was a little bit ahead of that.
Mm-hmm. It's actually turns out also to be a very difficult problem actually because at the critical temperature, then even though you have a small parameter, then you have a critical length diverges, and so one actually had to be some an infinite series of diagrams in that context, and this is why actually that was so many people actually came up with different answer because there was not very clear actually about how to proceed.
So it's probably nice that all of these connections are positive,
and you have
the critical temperature
to
the maximum somewhere.
Yeah, so that's okay, so I can point that out here. So here you see, for a long time, so when Nozier calculated this result, actually, he attributed this maximum in temperature as an artifact of the mean field theory. But we know from BCS temperature that the temperature increased here, and from these results we know that the temperature has to increase as you come down to this region. So one somehow has to have a maximum somewhere, and we don't know exactly where it is in this regime, but most naturally it's in the region where the scattering length diverges.
I never quite understood why. I mean, this calculation for positive shift of a pure Boltzmann gas. Now here we have fermions. Why do the fermions
sort of
contribute to
convection
in the same model?
You can ask,
guy. Well, I haven't done those calculations with the fermions, but typically this calculation with bosons, everything is accumulated at long length scale, which is much bigger than the size of the molecule. And so my guess would be that the fact that these kind of composite objects will eventually appear in this expansion somewhere, but not in the first few zeros. That's typically what happens. But I cannot speak for this expansion, of course. Exactly where it's
so sorry, that all, everything below the line is just a pure the individual boson.
You mean this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. This
and
is for
all those numbers are also.
The line, the table here was actually for, for bosons, actually. That's right.
So the general state energy is actually known at what point you'll start seeing your different composite particles, which is the same point where for the point bosons we need to take into account three body scattering.
Okay, yeah.
Basically, the point at which zero.
You mean this one?
So it appears actually this one, when there are dots, there's one more term which is unaffected, and then the next term gets affected.
Okay.
If you have an analytic expression for the first correction.
For the first
TC
here? Yeah.
The leading term is analytic, but the next term is a numerical.
That's right.
Is that possible to have an analytic expression? You know, in a sense, I wonder why it's so high.
It's a preparation. We don't have to do preparation.
So one would think so, right? Well, I guess it's no. So there is actually no analytic result actually that people can do that.
There was one work a few years ago by Kerzon Kwan where he said that the correction is negative.
That's right, yeah.
Actually, this work has been placed on the web on the 1st of April, several years ago.
Okay.
I don't
yes, somehow he was omitted from that table, actually. So he was the only one with a negative sign. And, Okay, I'll just skip that here, okay. So now I'll after this rather long introduction, so I'll turn on to what one can do with these epsilon expansion and SBN business. So let me turn this. Yeah. So one then is actually interested that, so as I told you, there's no small parameter which one can control at unitarity. So we can make expansion in the extreme BEC regime or BCS regime where KF times the scattering length is small. And one is interested in the regime at unitarity, for various reasons. One is actually that most of the experiments are done at unitarity for practical reasons, because right now, if they want to study the system at the in the BCS limit, so for a small negative scattering length, then they have the problem of reaching very low temperature because the critical temperature is highly suppressed. Because and on the BEC regime, actually, where the critical temperature is roughly the same, what happened is there's a technical reason why you have free body recombination in this regime, and so it's often not possible. So the system is not stable at this density, and so most of the experiment are performed actually in this unitarity. The second actually is that it's the results are actually very much universal at the unitarity, and I'd like to actually give a few line derivation that shows actually that a lot of scaling actually that happens at unitarity, because the fact that the scattering length diverges. So I told you on very general ground one could write let's say a free energy density, which would be if I can parameterize it as EF times a density, so that's times a function which can depend only on two parameters, KAS minus 1, and then KBT over EF. Now, if one is interested to work at unitarity, then this, and at zero temperature, this here is only is a constant. So F is equal to 3/5 EF n times. I should actually use another picture of this function psi. And I choose 3/5 because it's going to be convenient early on, although you could always, of course, dump it in there. And again, I want to emphasize, so EF is, in this context of atomic physics, is always, so KF is by definition related to 3 pi squared times n, the density of fermions, and EF is also h bar squared KF over 2m. So this means that the free energy is, goes like n to the 5/3. So if one, writes it out explicitly, it goes like 3/5 h bar squared over 2m times 3 pi squared 2/3 times n to the 5/3. Now, if one would like to calculate properties of this, if we like calculate what's the energy to add a particle to the system, then one can evaluate that by taking a derivative of the free energy density with respect to the density, and then what comes out 5/3, which is going to cancel out this term here, and if one rewrites this term here, we find that, oops, I forgot my little constant here, one gets EF times psi. If one would like to calculate the average energy per particle, then it's the free energy density divided by n, and then one end up with table 5 and EF side. So one end up with a very non-trivial result that the average energy divided by the chemical potential is just 3/5, actually. So even though I was telling you this is a very hard problem to solve, actually, the very simple relation that one can establish between various quantities merely due to the fact that you have scaling. So here, usually if KFS would not be zero, then this actually would have KF, or rather density appear there, so you would need to take a derivative with respect to this thing. And in general, mu and the average energy per particle would not be have a simple relation. So in the same way, one can also calculate, if you look at the bulk modulus, which is b, which is n squared times the derivative of f squared over n squared, and that turns out to be 0.2. If one takes the proper derivatives, you take the second derivative, gives 5/3, and then you're left with 2/3 again, so you get 2/3 of N over EF. And we know that the first sound, actually, B, is equal to the bulk modulus divided by NM, square root. So one has that, and I forgot again, this parameter psi. So we have that 2/3 psi times EF over M. Or if you want to rewrite this, this is just EF times psi divided by 3. So you see this parameter, which is unknown psi, we don't know what it is, but actually it appears in actually many physical quantities in the system. And this is one of the things we'd like to know actually precisely. From the point of view of Leggett, we can go from the BEC to the BCS smoothly. So what we don't know is actually, so we don't expect anything drastic to happen at unitarity. So the name of the game is actually to be able to, establish in a quantitative fashion some of the parameters that determine the physical quantities, such as, for instance, psi. And psi actually, has been the object of, much interest. The experimentalists like to call this 1 minus beta for reasons which are unknown to me. This actually within mean field, this is value of psi, is equal to 0.5906. On very general grounds, since we know that this is the result of mean field here, and mean field is a variational principle, which is directly related to the energy of the system here. And so this is always going to be an upper bound to the real energy of the system. So we know that psi here has to be smaller than this value of 0.59. Although it seems actually that the experimentalists don't always some of the estimates actually are larger than that, but it's not exactly clear why, although they have at present rather large error bars. So this is only one given parameter we would like to determine. There's also, since everything scales as a function of EF, so we know that we like to determine, things such as the excitation gaps as a function of EF is going to be another quantity that we'd like to know. TC over EF. And again, so mu over EF, which is also related to this quantity xi. And so at unitarity, and so everything again scale again according to EF. And so we'd like to establish in a quantitative fashion these parameters. And okay, so since we don't have a small parameter to start with, the idea which was explored in these papers is, you know, to use the technology from critical phenomena. So we know that in critical phenomena at the critical point, let's say critical temperature, we don't have a small parameter to deal with, and there's various tools that people have used, such as the epsilon expansion or large N for Malzahn to extract some of these quantities. And so I'd like to tell you a little bit more about this. Okay.
What was the Monte Carlo result for mu divided by epsilon curve? I think it was not 0.59, it was smaller.
That, yeah, so on general grounds, you expect that to be smaller because this is a variational approach. So we know that the real xi has to be smaller than that value. And so there are various estimates from Monte Carlo, actually. They don't always agree with one another. So, but if you're referring the one at mu over EF at zero temperature, then so mu at t equals zero, then the picture seems to be fairly consistent, actually, for various Monte Carlo. And it's about 0.42. Give plus or minus 2 on the last digit because so I think people get 0.44 0.42, so they're pretty much in the same range. This is unlike TC over EF, where there's a factor of 2 between the various Monte Carlo estimate, which so that they're not very consistent yet.
Okay. That number can be related to xi.
So this number is actually xi. Yeah, that's right. This is xi. Yeah. So from that, that's right, from here. So this is a, if we want to be quantitative. This is kind of a benchmark we'd like to test our theory against. Okay, so there's so I'd like first to tell you a little bit about the epsilon expansion approach. And I know Sajdev talks a bit about it when he was here, but I'll present it in a different way. So he presented it in terms of the renormalization group idea, but there's actually very mundane way actually to present it, which is related to what happened for a bound state in a harmonic a spherical potential well. So let's imagine one has two particles, that have some mass m, and they can be their statistics don't matter, so it could be boson and fermions, and then they have a potential in between them. Okay, and then one can then go to the relative and center of mass coordinates, and then one gets a term which with 2 times mu plus V of R plus a kinetic term which I can between the particles, which I'll ignore from now on. So we'd like to solve the problem of a particle now with some potential V, which I'll take to be a square potential of width R naught and the depth B. And we'd like to solve this problem in not in three dimension, but in D dimension. And we find out actually that in D equal to 4 and 2, actually there's elements there actually that tells us that the problem actually at the unitarity is going to be very simple. So okay. So first, let's imagine. So let's solve actually what would be the wave function of such a wave function in such a well where the binding energy is actually exactly zero, which just means that you are at the unitarity point where this the incipient point where one is about to form a bound state. So then in D dimension, I recall that the Laplacian is just the R square plus D minus 1 divided by R dr. I should change capital D not to confuse this with the derivative. Okay, so let's say actually I solve the wave function inside that potential well. So then in that case, the phi of R is given by D minus. Case kappa square phi of R equals 0. And kappa is equal here to 2mb0 divided by h bar square. So we just here this I've just written this function h phi equal e phi, and I set e equal to 0 here because I want to look at what happened at unitarity where just about to form a bound state of energy 0. So one can, oops, I forgot a term here. So this is this equation is valid for R smaller than R naught. So when you're inside the potential. And in that case, one actually can write the solution of this in terms of a Bessel function. So this is phi is equal to R over R naught. It's some amplitude. N times kappa R 1 minus T over 2 times the Bessel function T minus 1 over 2 kappa R. So now we'd like to join that with the wave function outside this potential well, and this is where it gets interesting because we get that. This solution actually is, in this case, D minus 1 over R. Since we don't have a potential in this region, this is 0, and it has to be 0. And the solution of such an equation here for outside the potential well for R greater than R naught. Function that falls off like R 2 minus D, okay, times some amplitude. So that's an interesting result, which Nusinov noted actually, and I don't know if you can see why it's interesting, but that means something. That means that if you one would like to calculate what is the probability amplitude of being, let's say, in some region, the R, what's it, from some region on NUD and D dimension, so that gives you dr times r to the d minus 1. Then if one substitute that in, you get dr is equal r d minus 1 times r 2 minus d, I forget the square. So that gives you, let's see, 3 minus d. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so d minus 1 plus 2 minus 2d gives you 3 minus d here. So that means that you do this integral for d greater than 4, then this is goes like r not 4 minus d, and for d equal to 4, it goes like log of r not. Which means actually that most of the weight of this wave function sit not at large distance, but at distance which are within r not of your system. In dimension greater than 4, and also logarithmically in dimension equal to 4. So that prompted is enough to notice that since the wave function falls off so rapidly in higher dimensions, then for all intended purposes, when one need to anti-symmetrize the wave functions of these bosons, the problem one doesn't have to worry about that. And so this problem is actually reduced to just bosons, a wave function that is very localized at the region R naught. So in that case, there was actually in dimension greater than 4, the problem is reduced to having non-interacting bosons, actually. So if you have two fermions that attract one another, they form a bound state which is wave function is so small that they actually don't interact with any other bosons, and then what you end up with in dimension greater or equal to 4 is attractive fermions at unitarity, essentially just like non-attracting bosons. Just based on this very simple considerations.
Like D actually needs to be greater than 4.
You mean you can't really normalize this log at infinity? So so at dimension 4, it's kind of, you could consider that a marginal case actually, but still this actually diverges at small distances of R naught.
Most of
the wave function actually falls off, is contained within ESA. Okay, this is, of course, this argument is not valid exactly at R naught, but here it would be contained within a region which is very close to R naught, as opposed to in three dimensions, we actually it doesn't have actually any scale, so the function decays. Like, if it'd be in three dimensions, then the probability of finding these bosons very far away is actually so these two fermions very far away from one another is actually great. It's large. So that means actually, so in dimension greater than 4, then the fermion unitarity are essentially non-attracting bosons. And there's another result that we know also in dimension smaller or equal to 2. And I'm not going to go through the problem, but I'm sure you know the solution, that if you solve two particles in dimension two, then as soon as you turn on the interaction, they form a bound state here. So for a minute interaction, this Hamiltonian will develop actually a bound state. So that means that fermions at unitarity in D equal to, in this case, for dimension smaller than two, are essentially just like non-attracting boson, because this happened at infinitesimally small interactions. So that.
Why are they non-attracting?
So they are non-attracting because, so if you do solve the problem in two dimensions, as soon as you turn, so you ask actually, what is the criterion as a function of V for forming a bound state, and it's at V0 plus. Or I get, V0 minus, I should say. And so so then this essentially is V0, minus is essentially a problem of actually non-interacting fermions at the unitarity limit in two dimensions.
And you may also refer to V equal to 1, which is exactly solved by the Gottdahn Satz. And then when the interaction is extremely strong, you get the formation of pairs which behave themselves as sort of bosons repelling each other according to the Tonks regime. And this is equivalent to non-interacting fermions.
That's right, yeah. So, actually, this limit here for D is equal to 2 was actually known for a very long time. Although this one actually was
much more
recent for the dimension greater or equal to 4.
I'm trying to find out the truth. So, when D is bigger than 4, and if I'm not a very small, then it looks like most of the weight is on the tail.
So when R naught goes to zero, did I get the sign wrong here? It seems. Yeah, it looks as if I get the sign. No, that's correct. Okay. Yeah, that's correct. So when R naught goes gets very small, so if D is greater than 5, then as R naught goes to 0, then this gets larger and larger. So that means more
weight.
If you can say integrate this between two region, R and R prime, most of the weight will fall, here. Yeah. So they are essentially, then the boson is essentially, the fermions, these two fermions are essentially bound together at very short distances. And so then, and the wave function does not extend, so they're like non-attracting fermions.
Does the non-attracting boson, the hardcore boson, the same thing?
So hardcore bosons, you mean you put them on the,
The boson has no longer interaction, but it's on the
Sorry, I didn't get it. Well, the boson
has a shorter interaction.
Yes, they would interact if they happen to sit at a distance with an R naught. However, okay, so then if we want to study this system, we want to study them at some density, which is a separation, which is given by Kf to the minus 1. So if you take that density to be much larger than, so the separation between particles be much larger than R naught, then for all intended purposes, this doesn't happen actually. So this is not. But yeah, it's a good point. Okay. So I guess that's a picture now that one should have, so that in this, if you've got BCS and BEC, or this axis, this is minus 1 over KFA, then, and this is in D equal to 3, then at D equal to 4, let's say here, then we have a gas which is made of these non-attracting bosons here. Whereas in D equal to 2, we have these fermions here which are non-attracting, so that's D equal to 2. And the idea now is to attack the problem along this direction. So, okay, so this is, so what I think I'm, for the sake of time, actually, I'm not going to go through this, the calculation. So what I'll, what I can show you, though, is that, calculate again this two fermion scattering in a vacuum, in this dimensional regularization, and then see actually that very crude argument I gave you about solving the problem in using just quantum mechanics actually is recovered in the language of field theory. Okay, so if one would like to calculate the T matrix between two fermions, so let's see, a spin up and spin down that interact via a contact interaction, then one would like to calculate the effective T matrix, and so we cannot use the Born approximation if the interaction is large, and what one has to do is actually sum over a set of bubble diagrams. So this is sum of a number of loops for n goes to 0 to infinity, and then in the process, so if one writes this T matrix, one realizes this is only valid in vacuum, so that you have only two fermions going in the same directions always, and no counterpropagation because you, you are in the vacuum, and so if one writes the T matrix, then one gets the TK. Sigma is just 1 over lambda, that's the interaction strength, and plus this, the Green's function of actually your fermions. Okay, and if one does that, actually one finds that this goes like 1 over, if one does that in D dimensions, this goes like, after integration, this goes like 2 pi to the D, 1 over 2 E K, the energy of the fermions you integrate over, plus E Q over 2 minus sigma plus psi delta. Okay, and then if one uses so this actually you can see in dimension greater than 2, this will diverge this term. So this goes like Ek goes like k square over 2m, and in dimension greater of 2, this goes like proportional to k. So you get 1 over k, sum over k will diverge. But you can regularize this actually just as like I did in adding a counter term which goes like 1 over 2 Ek on side. Or you could do that in dimensional regularization, in which case actually you get that. This is a prescription that we know from high energy physics. It goes like 1 and you pull out gamma functions and d over 2 minus sigma plus Ek over 2 minus I delta times d over 2 minus 1. So this is the end result for the T matrix. And now, so if you express now the T matrix in dimension 2 or 4, the inverse of this function gamma actually as a pole actually, so this is equal to infinity, and so the T matrix then vanishes. So that means, so only means actually you have, you know, non-attracting fermion in D is equal to 4 and in D equal to 2. And what one can do actually then is do an epsilon expansion where D is no longer an integer but intermediate between 2 and 4. So if you one does that in 4 dimension, so 4 minus epsilon, and one rewrites T making an expansion, then one finds that this goes like minus 8 pi epsilon square pi square times this in that case for D equal to 4 you get 2 minus 1. So this, if you look at T itself, you get the inverse, which goes like gamma minus P square over 2m plus I delta. So the interpretation of this now is actually that your T matrix is represented by, and effectively we have replaced your T matrix by a propagation of like a bosonic mode, which goes like this is, you can think of this as a bosonic mode of energy P squared over 2m. And this is as a strength, which of course vanishes if you're in dimension equal to 4. And then this is, this has a strength, then G, if you want, here, which would be given by, let's say, this coefficient, 4 pi E squared over M. So this is consistent. So all the interactions between fermions are actually propagated by these bosons, and those are the bosons that we had here, actually. So this is the non-interacting bosons are propagating the interactions between the fermions when you're at a distance epsilon from D equal to 4. And so then, so using this result, then Nishida and Sun went ahead and just performed an epsilon expansion from D is equal to 4. And one can do a similar trick in two dimensions, 2 plus epsilon dimension, where now the T matrix in D is equal to 2 is actually just 2 pi epsilon over M. So this is just the interaction between, if you want, so contact interactions between fermions of strength 2 pi epsilon times m. So if epsilon goes to zero, exactly in two dimensions, then you have non-interacting fermions. So what I can tell you now is the result actually they get from this is now the use of this theoretic, you know, tricks to calculate now the value of epsilon that was mentioning above, and they get. So that this is a T matrix of fermions. So yeah, so it does produce non-attracting boson. If you in D exactly equal to 4, then epsilon goes to 0. Right, so this. So you have so if you would have fermions in the system that would not be paired, they could not interact. So essentially, they all want to form a bosons, and they don't interact with one another in that case. So because they can, the interaction can only be mediated by this. Yeah. That's right. So you have a pole here which carries the interaction between these bosons. So you don't have independent fermions that can carry the interaction. Okay. So I'll just quote this result for now. Epsilon, for which people work pretty hard to do. So it goes like. So this is. So all these papers here, Nishida, Son, this two papers, this one and this one, they just here calculated the first order, second order, and this the last one they went to third order, and then they, at first so. This goes epsilon 5/3. You notice this coefficient actually it turns out to be very small actually compared to the first one. So they thought, we're in pretty great shape actually. And then that's 5/2. But then they went on to calculate the next term, and then they discovered that it's not so small actually, 0.9596 epsilon to the 7/2. And minus 3/8 E 9.5 log of epsilon. However, they use the fact that they know also the result exactly at D is equal to 2, and then they use these tricks where Borel and Paddy approximants to match the two summation. And so they end up actually with the result, which is psi. So this is from the result in D is equal to 4 minus epsilon. And they have another result for D is equal to 2 plus epsilon. They match things together, and then at the end of the day, you got epsilon to be 0.39 at this level, which is quite comparable to the result that was get from Monte Carlo, which was 0.42. And of course they can calculate other quantities, but such as TC and chemical potential and delta. So that's all I wanted to say about the epsilon expansion. I don't know if I should go ahead and talk about the large N expansion. What do you think, actually?
We have a chat.
Well, I think we can continue some of whether
okay.
And large N is actually part of the set of your contributions, so maybe you do want to let us some idea about
Okay.
Those who have to smoke a cigarette during the
meal. Okay. Well, okay, I can explain it in a sketch or so, only the details. It turns out to be actually a little bit more straightforward than this. And so I'll just give the... Again, it gets technical, but in the sense that... So the idea is actually to write a model for which we know the solution exactly. And so one, right, the generalization of our Hamiltonian, which is a different Hamiltonian than the one we want to solve, but we know its solution exactly. So it goes like we introduce n fermions, which have all the same mass and same chemical potential. And so you want to sum over these various flavors, which I'll call goes from 1 to I, and they also, each flavor carries a spin at sigma, and they have an interaction term, which is lambda divided by n, and then again you sum over this different flavor index I up and down. So what's important, if you have a pairing between, well, let's see, this is, let's see, I here, J here, down, psi, J up. Okay. So you see that this model, obviously, if you take n equal to 1, then you have only one fermion flavor, and it reduces the model that we want to solve. And the idea is actually that if we have no n flavor of it, we pair, well, this is a flavor that connects I to I here. So this field that we have here will acquire an expectation value, which will not have a lot of fluctuations. So if you write then, you know, the partition function, the trace, of course, is going to be go like e minus beta h, and because you have n flavor, then this is going to be multiplied by n. And for large n, that means that this trace is actually going to be dominated by your saddle point. And that saddle point for n equal to infinity then becomes the exact solution. And it, because of the appropriate choice we made, it turns out that this is equivalent to the mean field solution that one does approximately at n equal to 1. And so, which is neat actually, because as opposed to this epsilon expansion where your starting point is actually, for instance, in these fermions, they're not in a superfluid regime, here at n equal infinity, because the solution is the mean field solution at n equal to 1 is in the superfluid regime, so it's the same. If you want, is closely related to the solution we should have at n equal to 1. And now the way we go about the fact that we know the solution at n equal to infinity and we want to know the solution at n equal to 1 is to consider then fluctuations around this n equal infinity solution. And this at first is nothing but at the first order Gaussian fluctuations. And so I'll spare you a little bit the algebra. So what one can do is actually introduce a Hubbard-Svetanovich field, in this case here, which represents phi, which is a summation of I of psi I of psi I down. and write the entire action in terms of this field and integrate out completely actually the fermionic fields. And if one does so in the process, one finds that the action S is minus S pi square divided by lambda plus trace log of G minus 1. And this G minus 1 is the Green function over something which is the derivative tau plus this is the propagator of the fermion. So in that case here, what we have is if at n equal infinity, the fluctuation of this B field is small, this becomes a constant, which is a saddle point solution. But we can allow for fluctuations for if n is not equal to infinity around that saddle point solution and expanding 1 over n. And what we did actually in this paper is look only at the first order correction, which is the simplest one, and it's just given by, in this case, a Gaussian fluctuation around the saddle point. And since I think actually, so yeah, so in the process, then one can actually also calculate correction to psi delta in TC. And I guess I'll probably just, yeah, I could give you some of the results we derived so that, for instance, delta over EF is 0.6864. So this is actually at n equal infinity. Well, so the first term is the result from n equal infinity, which is the result of the mean field solution. So that was a result that was well known. And then we can add, you know, correction to 1 over n that we calculated. So this is actually, there's no relation between the two, actually, that we know. It's a different parameter, yeah. And this is for the order parameter, and there's also delta, the excitation gap, which is not the same, actually. Single particle excitation, which is actually this one that was determined. They're equal in mean field here, yeah, just really, but they're different in 1 over n. And this is something which was claimed to be 0. Was calculated in Monte Carlo, which was 0.51. If you naively substitute n equal to 1, you get 0.49 or so. Although, again, we don't know actually the expansion beyond the first order, and maybe the next order could be large in principle, actually. And we know on very general ground that this is only a asymptotic series, so there's no radius of convergence of these actually expansion. Nevertheless interesting actually to see if one goes beyond the first order, beyond the Gaussian fluctuation, then what corrections actually we get, and does that actually converge to something closer to the solution is known. Okay. We did calculate psi as well, actually. So if you want it, it's actually, in that case, we don't do as well, actually. That's why I wasn't putting it on the board. So this 0.506 minus 0.2. So that's actually, yeah.
Divided by n.
Divided by n, of course, yeah. So this is, this is only a factor, two different, yeah. So. Yeah. So compared to this value here, yeah.
You listed a lot of works here.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, I think that this is Dash there, this is Rockland, but actually high energy physics and people from cosmology did a lot of work with unit divided by N expansion. And that was, for example, the work from the University of Iowa a few years ago, 1.5 years ago, where they did this unit divided by N expansion. Do you know this work from Thomas Gadens and so on?
I'm not aware of it, no.
And then also Christoph Hiedering did the work, and some other people. I do not remember exactly, but
you think it's
physicists and people from cosmology. And in cosmology, they do this unit divided by N expansion all the time, and N in their case is 6, so I forgot, so it's large.
Mm-hmm.
And they have done some work, and they were arguing that it's so good and so on, the expansion. I think, I don't remember how many terms of the expansion they found. That's what I don't remember.
Okay.
This work is on the web.
Okay.
More or less, no. I would just want to ask you, what is the result of the comparison of your results with their results?
So I don't know if they look also at the specific. I mean, you don't have to look exactly at unitarity in principle.
They exactly look at unitarity.
Okay. So then, yeah. So then that'd be worthwhile actually to compare.
Okay.
Okay, yeah.